proceed with the next case of the morning. It'll be Israel Akala versus Emhart Industries.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Alan Mendelson. I represent Isidro Akala. This is a case involving personal injuries, Your Honor. Your Honors, the gist of the case is that Mr. Akala's hand was mangled in a splitting machine that was manufactured by Turner Tanning Machinery Company sometime in World War I.
Is there anywhere in the record a picture of this? What this thing looks like? I mean, it sounds
there is
like
in
an
my
antique.
Response to motions for summary judgment, but I thought you might ask. A splitting machine is two rolls, like your washer or wringer, the old-fashioned washer wringers, and a tire is inserted between the rollers. On the other side of the rollers, there's a belt knife that's rotating. So the rollers flatten out the piece of rubber being inserted and the rollers pull the tire into the knife, which splits it like this. One top goes up, one top goes down. There's a man on the other side that catches these things as they go through the knife.
So the tire is then split in half?
The tire is got the same outside perimeter, but it's just thinner. And they take these thinner parts and make washers and other things out of them. Useful. It's a good recycling idea.
Okay, that's what it is. All right. This is a recycling process because it apparently was originally manufactured to split leather.
There's a dispute about that. Turner manufactured leather splitters and rubber splitters. Our evidence showed that there was a ring roller supposedly on the leather splitters Turner made, which wasn't on their rubber splitters. The splitter that hurt Mr. Akala lacked the ring roller, indicating it was manufactured for rubber, because they made both kinds.
This particular machine had been modified many times.
That's right.
Many times over the years.
But the only thing that
not by
wasn't
the manufacturer,
modified,
right?
That's correct. The analogy is like to a car is manufactured with an unsafe seatbelt. So the car could last, you could change the engine, you could change the transmission, you could change the brakes, you could change the muffler. But so long as that defective seatbelt is never changed, it's still in the same condition as originally manufactured and unmodified.
Well, by analogy, the car built in 1940 didn't have seatbelt.
Pardon?
The car, so somebody basically installed one. Then you got a different product, don't you?
No. The evidence was uncontested that the manufacturers in World War I, reasonably careful manufacturers, made splitting machines with guards on them, whether it be for rubber or leather. That was the uncontested evidence. The evidence was also overwhelming that Turner never put a guard on its splitting machines.
But there was evidence. I mean, let me kind of get down to the points, at least you raised in your brief. You raised some points about the voir dire, and you also raised some points about the jury instructions. But the points that you were raising, I'll take the jury instructions since that seems to be where we are right now. The points that you raise make it seem as though you think this is a strict liability case,
no.
But it wasn't. It was a negligence.
No, it was definitely negligence
case. It was a negligence case, and the instructions that you're mentioning are not instructions given in negligence cases. And there was also evidence that the jury apparently credited, that there was some adjustment to this very machine that could have been made that would have solved the problem, would have prevented this terrible accident to Mr. Akala.
What happened was Alcala's employer was Lakin General Company. They owned the machine. They employed Mr. Akala. The evidence was sometime in the 1970s, coincidentally, about the same time OSHA came into effect, Lakin decided to manufacture its own guards and put them on the machine. The evidence is that at the time of Alcala's injury, there was a guard, not manufactured by the manufacturer, but manufactured by the employer Lakin, which obviously didn't work.
Well, because it was the testimony was that it was adjusted the wrong way. But I guess all I'm saying is the jury seems to have gotten appropriate instructions for a negligence theory. And at that point, you know, it's up to the jury. I'm not saying no jury could have found otherwise, but if the jury found as it did, I'm not sure what this court can do.
The jury wasn't adequately instructed in the law of negligence for defective products, negligence theory. And if you read the briefs, there is no Illinois pattern jury instructions for negligence for dangerous products. The instructions I submitted comply with the law.
So why should there be a separate instruction? Why aren't just the generic negligence instructions
because they apply to ordinary people, not manufacturers. The Illinois Supreme Court has definitely said that a manufacturer is under a duty to make a non-delegable duty to make a reasonably safe machine, and they're held to the standard of care of experts.
Well,
that's the law of negligence in Illinois.
Where
that's the latest
that
case
from
205 in the case of Blue versus Environmental Engineering. General negligence instructions do not apply to the duty of and the breach of duty of a manufacturer.
What are you talking about, a reasonable manufacturer or a reasonable person?
There's a difference, a reasonable manufacturer and a reasonable person.
There's a level of knowledge that you're going to impute to the manufacturer.
That's right.
But the duty of care is still the same duty
to do a reasonable thing as a manufacturer. Jury hearing, they have a duty as a reasonable person.
It's not a higher duty, though. It's just that you, just like you would hold a doctor, you know, in a medical malpractice case, to a different level of knowledge than you would.
That's a good analogy. In a medical negligence case, you would not instruct the jury that the doctor has to use the care of an ordinary person. In a medical negligence case, the jury is instructed that the duty of the doctor is to possess the knowledge and use the skill of reasonably well-qualified doctors, not ordinary persons. So in our case, we stand like in the position of a doctor in a medical malpractice case. The duty is different, not the duty of an ordinary person. And while we're on the instructions...
But of course it's not strict liability.
It's not strict liability, no. And I never approached this case as a strict liability case because that would be barred by the statute of repose under a strict liability theory. Negligence theory are not so barred. The most important thing about the instructions is the non-delegable item. It was Turner's duty to make a machine reasonably safe. They cannot escape responsibility because the employer, Lakin, put on an ineffective guard. And we know it was ineffective and didn't work properly because the guy's hand got caught in it. So their argument to the jury was, well, Lakin put a guard on. That wasn't adjusted properly at the time of this injury. So
how big is this tire compared to the size of the hand?
Pardon?
How big is this tire? Is it
it's a tire tread. You can take a tire tread. They're maybe 10, 12 inches wide.
So it's got
to
be...
They cut the sides off, and they take just the tread, and they put the narrow end into this machine.
Okay, so...
And there was... two bars in between that they had these pegs sitting in. So they take some pegs out so that the tire tread would fit in between, and the fellow would stand on the outside and feed in the tire tread. In this case, it stopped going just before it finished. So he looked around, called for help. No help came. He had seen other employees push in the past. So he pushed a little bit, and unbeknownst to him, all of a sudden the rollers grabbed the machine, in goes his hand, all the way up to the mid-forearm, slicing off the top half of his hand and forearm. My time is up. I want to save a little time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Right for your rebuttal. Ms. Campbell?
May it please the court. We're here on two specific legal issues, but I think there is one general principle we should keep in mind when we review this case, and that is that this court should not overturn a jury verdict and not find an abuse of discretion in the denial of a new trial if there's a reasonable basis in the record to support the jury verdict, and if it would not serve the ends of substantial justice to order a new trial. And I think some of the court's questions this morning and some of the discussion about the evidence underscores why this was an appropriate verdict and that neither of these points that have been raised would support a finding of abuse of discretion in the failure to grant a new trial. Despite Mr. Mendelson's most noble efforts, this was a case that was virtually unwinnable. It dealt with an antique machine that had been designed at World War I. We don't know who it was originally sold to. We don't know how many changes the original owner made to the machine, or how many owners there were between that first owner and Lakin, who owned it at the time of the accident. What we do know is that looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, which is the standard we need to apply, that this was originally designed as a leather splitting machine, not a rubber splitting machine. And there was various evidence showing that, both because of the width of the machine. Mr. Pratt, who was an Emhart or Turner employee, testified that based on his experience and knowledge and the various parts, this would have been a leather splitting machine. We do know that Lakin changed the machine in many different ways. They changed motors, switches, control boxes, installed stop buttons, and most significantly, they installed two different guards over the course of the years that they owned this machine.
Let me ask you this. Given that the nature of this accident was that the machine grabbed his hand and pulled it in with the tire, are there any other elements of the machine? As you say, changing motors, I'm wondering if the speed with which the rollers turn is a factor here, or the distance between the rollers, or are there any other mechanical elements of the machine that would make this more or less likely to happen, other than just putting a guard in front of the rollers? See, I'm just trying to figure out, in terms of these modifications over the years, this thing is built in whenever, let's even say 1918, and now we're in the last part of the 20th century, early 21st century. Which modifications, to take his example, is it like the seatbelt that's never modified, or is it like some piece that does get modified?
I'm not sure if I understand the court's question.
Well, what I'm saying, if it was built without a guard, it never had a guard. Maybe it's always been too dangerous. Maybe it was negligent, even in 1918, to build a machine with no guard. On the other hand, if it's not really the same machine anymore, if the rollers are going twice as fast, so the risk of getting your hand caught has also changed, maybe the guard isn't the only factor that leads to the dangerousness of the machine.
I think that's true. I think that the machine had changed so much that what Mr. Pratt said during his testimony was that a Turner machine. It was no longer a Turner leather splitting machine because so much of it had been altered that he essentially said, although I could recognize parts that were familiar and that would indicate that Turner had made this at one time, for example, the cast iron metal framing hadn't changed. There had been so many other changes to the machine that it no longer resembled a Turner leather splitting machine. And in fact, the Lakin employees testified that they never got any replacement parts, and they had gotten many over the years. They had never gotten any from Turner or Emhart. So I think that that is true. And also what the evidence showed was that a guard that would work on a leather splitting machine and a guard that would work on a rubber splitting machine are two different animals. And so they're not interchangeable. And so the jury could have decided that even if there was no guard on the machine at the time of manufacture, which was never proven or disproven, and it was the plaintiff's burden to show. But even if there hadn't been a guard, that had there been a guard for a leather splitting machine, it still wouldn't have been effective for the use that it was put decades and decades later. So this is a bit afield from the legal issues, which have been thoroughly examined in the briefs, but I do think it's important in how we view this case. On the legal issues, on the jury voir dire, all I will say is that this was an uncontroversial negligence case where there was no issue of some socially controversial point that jurors might be conflicted over, and there was no question that if the plaintiff proved liability, it was a case worthy of a reasonable amount of damages because he clearly had a significant injury. He lost all his fingers. So The voir dire issue is not a point for reversible error. On the jury instructions, I think the court has recognized one of the many problems with these instructions being that they were geared more for a strict liability case, which this was not. I do contest this concept that there is nothing in the pattern jury instructions that suggests that you don't just use ordinary negligence instructions in a product case based on negligence. The 400 series, which deal only with strict products liability, tell you to not use them in negligence cases. And the Eves case that we cited specifically finds that in a product case based on negligence theory, that you should use the regular negligence pattern instructions. In that case, they used 1004 on the issue of duty, which is from the chapter of the pattern instructions titled Negligence and Ordinary Care. So that case holds just the opposite of what plaintiff's position is and says you do use the ordinary negligence instructions in a negligence case, whether it be slip and fall or product liability or any other variation of a negligence case. I just wanted to point one factual thing, this discussion about that there was no ring roller. The testimony was that there was no ring roller at the time of the incident. We don't know, based on the evidence. The plaintiff never showed that there was no ring roller at the time of manufacture. But again, this just goes to the point that you have to look at the evidence in the light favorable to the defendant, and that was that this was originally a leather-splitting machine. The jury instructions that the plaintiff asked for were not approved instructions. They confused the concepts of negligence and strict liability. They impermissibly intermingled concepts of duty and level of knowledge. And on this delegable duty issue, it was really a red herring because the defendant never contended that it didn't have a duty to use ordinary care. It never contended that it had delegated that duty to someone. Instead, our whole argument turned on the point that the plaintiff could not prove that anything that was done in terms of the design of this product almost 100 years ago was the proximate cause of his injury 80 years later. And they've confused the concept of non-delegable duty and proximate cause. So the court properly rejected that instruction as well. If the court has no questions, I just ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mendelson? You've got about 1 minute.
Wow. All right. As far as changes in the machine goes, we had the original designs, internal manufacture, the machine designs. The rollers and everything fit according to the Turner designs for rubber splitters. So the position of the rollers, the position of the knife, the failure to guard, all were original design. They may have changed the motor, they may have changed other things, but the nip point, the thing that caught Mr. Alcala's hand, was never changed. They cite the Eves case, but 12 years after the Eves case, the Illinois Supreme Court decided the Blue case that definitely talks about, and what you should know, is the law of negligence pertaining to dangerous machinery, the negligent design and manufacture of machinery. As far as voir dire is concerned, what's important to us is the attitude of the jury, the individual jurors. What is their attitude? What are their opinions about cases like this? Their name, age, job history, injury history doesn't tell us anything about what their preconceived notions might be. Asking a simple question, like what is your opinion about personal injury lawsuits, would tell us if they harbored any preconceived notions or mindsets that would be against either side. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.